that now it is my opportunity to laud my co-moderator, Mimi Rosenberg, who is, she's a legend. What can you say? She's a lawyer. She's a radio host and producer. She's an activist. There isn't a topic that this woman cannot master. I had a house.
I thought you were going to say mangle.
No, not mangle, but master. I had a housing conference in Harlem a number of years ago, and I had Mimi on the program. The woman blew everyone out of the water because she compared the Palestinian struggle with the struggle against gentrification in Harlem. It was absolutely incredible. But that is the incredible Mimi Rosenberg.
Well, thank you. Actually, the only thing that I think is really incredible is everything. Every single person here who has committed their lives and their hearts and their minds to the process of egalitarianism, to social justice, and it's absolutely clear we will prevail. We have brought home some of our political prisoners within the last 2 years. That should serve as inspiration to continue to redouble our effort for those who gave the most and paid the most severe price. Now, what I've been asked to do by Ralph is, first of all, for those of you who have some colleagues who are still gobbling up the good food, go round them up, get them in here. We are going to start in a moment with this wonderful film trailer, but we want to take just 2 more minutes, as did Brother Shep. Has anybody got a forum or demonstration coming up in the next couple of days? We want to use this opportunity to do some quick announcements. There should be hundreds.
Where is Freedom House? You have an activity that is coming up.
Okay, come on, sister.
Come on.
Oh, here's a woman who just once in a while does some political...
Very quickly.
Thank you. Emily. I want to invite everyone to Freedom Hall on Saturday, February 28th for a Black History Month community meeting, a call to action, end the siege on Black lives. And it's going to be an open conversation. Everyone's invited to participate. We'll have 2 speakers kicking off the dialogue. Leah Z. Owens, who is a leader in the Newark Education Workers Social Justice Union Caucus, and Sarah Scott from Freedom Socialist Party in Seattle. And it's sponsored by the Comrades of Color Caucus of Radical Women and the Freedom Socialist Party next Saturday, February 28th at 7 p.m.
And, of course, we have to say that Emily Wu, we got our sister. I can't let you get away without saying, 2 seconds, Melissa Alexander, come on. You help do it.
So with the organizing of... the Black community and feminists and social justice activists around the country and some international pressure. People may know that Marissa Alexander actually is out of jail. She did take a plea, but it was a victory of sorts because it was only through the pressure and the organizing of people like you in this room that we saved her from 60 years in prison.
And then there's a really important announcement.
Okay. William Camacaro, who I think of as the champion of our comrades in Venezuela.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here with all of you guys. We are inviting everybody this coming March 5th to be with us in a demo that we're organizing against Human Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch is always certificating whatever the State Department said. Few weeks ago, the State Department imposed through Obama administration sanctions to Venezuela government a few days after, supposedly for human rights violation. Few days after, Human Rights Watch released a report denouncing human rights violation in Venezuela. So basically, Human Rights Watch was certificating what the State Department was saying. And all the time, it has been very consistent. All the time they have been supporting whatever the State Department say against Venezuela, Human Rights Watch is there to support the State Department. So we want us to be with us this coming March 5th at 4 p.m. in front of the Empire State Building, of course, because it's belong in defense, the State Department, they are located in the building of the state. then the Empire Building, they are located. So we will be there, and then we will walk to the Venezuelan consulate. Thank you.
William Colocado.
Yes, and our final announcement is going to be from Bernard White. As some of you may know, if you listen to WBAI Radio, they're in Fun Drive. Thank you, Steve. Got to cite some of your poetry on that. Okay, Bernard White, who is going to do a special on WBAI Radio. It is part of their fun drive. And he's going to talk about that very briefly. And we will quickly move on with the program after Bernard White.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll be very brief. Tomorrow, 12 to 5, special on Malcolm X. Tune in. Bye.
Okay, we're going to. First of all, are people warm? And are they warm because we're family? And we're a family of the... special members of our that welcome and the surprise for two of our most precious returnees, who we're going to give Sister Lynn Stewart the honor of welcoming back to the beloved community. But Sister Flavia has been working. Thank you. Has been working for several years now to complete. What is it, Lynn?
15
years.
Since the day that Lynn Stewart was arrested.
Since the
15 years on this documentary. There's another piece that is completed, and we're going to watch it right now. Thank you again for being who you are and being with us.
Okay, folks, get ready for an excerpt from this great film, and stick around because the best is yet to come.
On April 9th, 2002, I was arrested as I stepped out of the front doorway of my home in Brooklyn by the FBI. They took me to their lockup where I was processed. I appeared in front of the judge later that day. And I was released on a $500,000 bond, which was signed by my three children.
Lynn Stewart has been in jail 3.5 years, and she is dying of cancer.
The prison officials acknowledge, the prison doctors, that she doesn't have a long time to live. We want her back in New York to have a fighting chance with cancer. Therefore, every day counts. I visited Lynn this morning at Fort Worth in the prison. I believe I was the second person in. I got there at 7 a.m. And Lynn, spiritually, is the top of her game. But the reality is that cancer is killing her.
In May of 2000, I made a visit to the Rochester Medical Facility to visit my client, Sheikh Omar. While there, he asked me to make a press release on his behalf to the Arabic newspapers. It dealt with the matter of his point of view of current politics in Egypt. I made the press release. I recognized that he was held under special rules and regulations, and that part of those rules prohibited him having any contact with the media. Yes, I made a press release, and yes, I was admonished for it, and yes, I was cut off from the client for a period of 7 or 8 months. What happened next? I visit my client in July of 2001, and in September of 2001, we all know 9/11 occurs and the world shifts. Little did I think that it would shift to the degree that this old press release made 2 years earlier would be resurrected by the Justice Department under Ashcroft and become the subject matter for a terrorist indictment in which I would face 30 years in prison.
There was a long period of time after the alleged press release that she issued when she could have been charged and wasn't. It was not until after 9/11 that that was brought. Therefore, we have to see this indictment and trial within the context of the post 9/11 period.
And after 9/11, you had a reaction that was largely political against Muslim peoples everywhere. You had the government that was looking for cases, trying to develop as many cases against Muslims as it could to show how diligent it was in protecting the people of the United States.
It was General Ashcroft who decided, 2 years after the event, they asked him, well, what happened after she made this press release to Reuters? Did anything happen? He said, no, nothing happened. I had taught school for 10 years. I had been involved in a struggle, along with Ralph, to bring the schools to the community and have the community have a say, not have a say, but actually run the schools. By 1970, that struggle had been co-opted and lost, and I think I better think about doing something else. So the good Ralph says to me, well, what do you want to do? And I said, you know, I always thought about being a lawyer. So he said, well, then I guess you better be a lawyer.
I've known Lynn since I was a kid. You know, we grew up in the same building. You know, I got myself in trouble quite a few times. She's gotten me out of jail. If it wasn't for her, I'd probably be in jail right now or dead.
I believe that one of the things she cared too much for people, whatever nationality they are.
Free Lynn Stewart. She doesn't deserve it.
That's a nice woman, a beautiful woman, you know, she takes care of the community, she helps the community out, and she doesn't deserve what they're trying to do to her. You know what I mean? Because she's helping people out that's less fortunate than other people.
So after 3 decades as a lawyer, her reputation based on her representation of radicals and revolutionaries was all a far cry from the fresh-faced small-town girl who traded in the safe life as a school librarian for the passion and perils of a people's lawyer.
I first met Sheikh Omar, and he was going on trial here, and the whole Middle East was watching to see whether or not there would be a fair trial.
The Sheikh's followers were convicted of the first bombing of the World Trade Center back in 1993, and then 2 years later, he was convicted of plotting to blow up other New York landmarks. And when the Sheikh was found guilty, Lynn Stewart wept in court.
I believed, and I believe today, that he is wrongfully convicted.
We're talking today about a case that has split the legal community, as we'll see here in the studio.
First of all, it's not lawyer work at all.
She must have been acting as some kind of a lawyer because the government required her to sign agreements as a lawyer to go see her client as a lawyer. So I'm not quite sure that that kind of analogy holds true.
Is it your view that those agreements should not be binding, or that the law is bad, or that discretion was improperly exercised to bring about this prosecution?
To then elevate a public press release, two of them, into a material support for terrorism case seemed to me not only overreaching, but just, overkill.
There were press releases which showed definitively, when Sheikh Omar's supporters were skeptical, that he wanted to end Gamaat Islamiyah's ceasefire with the Egyptian government.
This particular defendant is one of the worst terrorists, worst defendants who's ever been prosecuted in the United States.
It's only by sheer dumb luck that nobody died as a result of what Lynn Stewart did.
Imposed a sentence of 10 years. We all think that it's outrageous, but it's a very harsh sentence in a very harsh system.
The judge seemed very tortured. He seemed to be almost in tears himself.
He could have stood up. It does show the levels of intimidation and pressure that are being imposed at every level.
But behind it all is both the fear of terrorism and the exploitation of your terrorism.
Lights. We have truth and justice, but we could use some light. That'll bring light. Okay. When I was at Sekou Odinga's Welcome Home on last Sunday, which I think was colder than this one, if that's how we're rating things, it was at least as cold. But one of the last people to speak was a young fellow. And that young fellow sang out from the stage. He sang out, "If I had lived 30 years ago, I would have been a Black Panther." Well, it was very endearing, but it was also very sad to me because he did not recognize that the need that generated the Black Panthers of the 60s into the 70s still exists, and that we still need to fight those battles once again. And since tonight, notwithstanding all the films and all the flyers and everything else, I mean, I'm small potatoes here, and that's a funny thing for us because Ralph always referred to himself when speaking with Sheikh Omar. He said, "I'm just small potatoes." And the Sheikh thought that was a very amusing way to refer to himself. But at any rate, I am small potatoes. 5 years, that's nothing. We have people with us tonight, and that is who this evening is dedicated to. The people who served, who showed us the wonderful, wonderful resilience, the courage of their convictions, and I don't mean that as a pun. I mean they served 10, 20, 30 years. And I'd like to introduce the ones that are with us tonight and bring them up to the front to either say a few words or just for you to give them recognition. I'd like to start, first of all, with someone many of you do not even recognize as being the oldest political prisoner or him with the oldest history of being a political prisoner. And I mean by that Joel Myers. Where is Joel? Step up, Joel. When I was a cute young thing in miniskirts, Joel was going to jail because he burned his draft card and refused to step forward and be inducted. We see Joel at many of our demonstrations. We see him at Union Square periodically, and he did time back then when everybody knew what that meant, was standing up to the government was something new. I also want to introduce at this point Sekou Odinga that I just mentioned. Seated next to Sekou is another notorious Black Panther, but of the Northeast variety, Kazi Toure. I think he just came to get away from all that snow in Boston. And on my left, Cisco Torres, our hometown boy. It's probably recently indicted as one of the San Francisco Eight and eventually stood up to them and came home one more time, hopefully to remain in Queens and be with us on all the things we all know we need to do these days. Next to him, Laura Whitehorn, 10 years. Also among us, I don't see her right now, but Kathy Boudin is here. And of course, she has fought a hard fight being as famous and notorious as she is. And I just remember her getting married to my client, David Gilbert, in Goshen, New York. Ralph says I'm doing a wrong thing because I didn't ask people to come down. I think there are constraints on people, Ralph, and you, of all people, should understand the constraints and not force people into a position they might not want to be in.
The constraints are parole, probation, and being in gatherings with people who are known political activists.
Associations. We're associating. We're not allowed to associate. But I decided as a can't forget my training, after a year home, I'm already thinking what arguments I could make to say this is an association, being at a meeting, being at a gathering. This is not association. Association is when four members from the mob go to a Sheepshead Bay diner and figure out who's going to split the take. But this is hardly associate. I wish we had a take to split, but we're... Anyway, I just want to say now, let me see now, who have I missed here? Please make yourself known. I'm not hearing
it. I didn't hear that. Stand, please.
Serene?
Serene. How you doing?
He's right in front of my eye, and I'm blind. But I think probably we all feel more than ever before the pain of the people who are not with us. And by them, I mean the people who have been in jail for 20 years, 30 years. I want to read to you a letter that Ralph received from Mutulu Shakur, who ran an acupuncture clinic in Harlem that cured addicts. Can you get my bag, Ralph? Mutulu Shakur, who was an outstanding member. And he wrote to Ralph, and I tell you, I could never read. When Ralph first got the letter, I couldn't read this without crying. And I still can't read it without crying. He wrote to Ralph, "So many of our freedom fighters, seemingly lost from the present generation." It's so sad. More so because they are lost without light to point the way. These brave souls who wait for the love of the people to free them is a demonstration of faith that no religion could imagine. And I say to you, we are the people he's talking about. We are the people, Mutulu, Sundiata. I can name them. You know them. They're on the lists for ABC. They're on the list for Jericho. They are in the prisons. People who are here tonight, we all who have been in prison know how terrible it is and how much it kills the spirit. It's a deadening of the human spirit. And when you get out, it is, for me, to know the people that worked so hard to do it. We have people that we are close to getting out, people like Oscar Lopez. I have a painting Oscar sent me. It's up behind all the food. It's a raven in a jail cell, and the razor wire goes around the top. And that is how I feel about the people, the men, the women, because I'll never forget in all the years, and all the years I represented many of them visited them in prison, I never came out not more enriched by the visit than it was by the fact that I was doing a kindness, a goodness. It wasn't about that. It was, my God, how wonderful these people are. How wonderful is David Gilbert. How wonderful is Sundiata. And I think you have to help us. You must help yourself, because these are the heroes. These are the guys. These are the women who stood up and stood up to be counted at a time when it was not, I won't say that. They stood up at a time when we really believed, and I still believe it, we can win. We can vanquish these evil. We can have a decent society and a decent revolution. We can have communities that control themselves. But we lost that. Everybody went to jail. And now we've got to get them out. That's our task. To me, we've got to bring them home, all of them. I was very fortunate, but I'm easy to love. I'm a nice white lady. I did good work in my lifetime. I did good legal work. I cared for people. I represented not only the political people, but as you could see from the film, that part that was filmed on the very block I lived on for 35 years, and those young men who said she was only good, she took care of all of us. Well, I did take care of all of them. And that's why I'll never be a millionaire lawyer that Father Lucas was referring to. But I at least had the pleasure of being in my own community and being somebody to these young people who really had no place to go. So at least they knew someone would fight for them. But now I want to urge all of you to join me in doing everything possible to bring home our brothers and sisters. And I'm not talking about what we have tried in the past. I'm not talking about more meetings like this. I'm not talking about marches. I'm not talking about maybe having a petition drive online. I'm talking about we're going to have to start taking some direct action. We're going to have to go to the governor's office. We're going to have to go there and stay there until he understands that there are people, hundreds of people, that want these men to come home, and all the cops in the world can't stop us. And that is the way it has to be. And we just, so I, when you're called upon for direct action, I hope you will be ready, willing, and happily able to take it on, because I think that's what the next step has got to be. I think we have to push. I think we have to do things that will garner publicity, because we are really unknown. I think we have to get into the churches like the Puerto Ricans did so well. I'm waving to Ana Lopez up there. They got in there. They got those churches organized. And they let those politicians know they couldn't be elected if they didn't support political prisoners.
Well, I can't help but say, when I think about saying free all political prisoners, we know who we have to bring home. And as a legal aid lawyer, I have to say that every single person behind the walls is a prisoner of this repressive, vicious system. And we can't rest until we tear down the system of incarceration and caging all our brothers and sisters. Having said that, further inspiration tonight, Brother Matulu Shakur, Brother Edward Pinckney, talking about the fight against gentrification and destroying a community, who just got a 10-year sentence. And we have the other Skype message from?
Minneapolis.
From who? Grand jury resistors. And Ralph's going to explain.
First, let me explain that the agenda you have has no relationship to reality. Because there was a person in the mix, an incompetent. And that incompetent listed one of Lynn's doctors, because I had papers in my pocket and I wasn't sure what they meant. And so it is my fault, but without further explanation, let us have voices from prison. Voices from prison. Ernesto, give me the...
For Lynn, this is Mumia Abu Jamal. Dear sisters, brothers, and friends, we come today not merely to celebrate the life and contributions of a remarkable person. We gather together to preserve her, her ability to fight the enemy of her life. I speak of the meaning of Lynn Stewart, no longer a lawyer perhaps, but still a teacher, hopefully, for generations to come. We need her to teach us about the law, how it really is. We need her to teach us about her life and struggle against the empire.
Some words from Yon Laman for my sister, Lynn Stewart. Like you, I love love, life, the sweet smell of things, the sky blue landscape of January days. And my blood boils up, and I laugh through eyes that have known the buds of tears. I believe the world is beautiful, and that poetry, like bread, is for everyone. And that my veins don't end in me, but in the unanimous blood of those who struggle for life, love, little things, landscape, and bread. The poetry of everyone, by Roque Dalton. Some words from Yon Laman for my sister, Lynn Stewart.
This is Sunyata Kohli. All political prisoners want freedom, and it's time we brought our political prisoners home. So let's step up our work together to make it happen. Let's bring them home. Free them all. Bring them home. I thank you.
So somebody asked me, what do you do now that you're disbarred? I said, I agitate. Those who profess to favor freedom yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. Frederick Douglass, this struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be a both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Thank you.
We promised you entertainment, and we are going to have some entertainment now, a little interlude, because this is a message of love to people. We will continue with the heavy stuff, the different stuff, but we're going to have some sweet love from our granddaughter, Serafina Brown, from Brooklyn.
CPRmetro.org.
It's fine. Someone told me long ago, there's a calm before the storm. I know, been coming for some time. When it's over, so they say, it'll rain. Sunny day, I know, shining down like water. I wanna know, have you ever seen the rain? I wanna know, have you ever seen the rain? Coming down on a sunny day. Yesterday and days before. Sun is cold and rain is hard. I know, been that way for all my time. Till forever on it goes, through the circle fast and slow. I know, and it can't stop, I wonder.
I wanna know, have you ever seen?
All right. She's consented to do a repeat of what she did last year.
Broadcasting live from St. Peter's Church in Manhattan.
Thank you. I think we should have all learned by now that this is hands off. Let's give another round of applause for this wonderful, talented granddaughter of Lynn Stewart, Serafina Brown. Entertainment and political analysis. In depth, who could be a better person behind that description other than Glenn Ford, the executive editor of Black Agenda Report? It's the news, analysis, and commentary from a Black left perspective, something that is sorely needed in the age of Obama. Let me quickly tell you, if I may, how I met this wonderful, brilliant man. In 2007, when Barack Obama, then senator, announced his candidacy, or rather the ruling class, corporate America, announced his candidacy for the highest office, and they were prepared to spend a great deal of money, and as it was, they spent $1 billion, more so than any other political campaign in the history of the country. So you knew almost immediately that we were in store for one of the greatest scams of the 21st century. So I was hosting a series of forums in Harlem. Steve was there among some of the many. We had them at a church in Harlem. And I was looking around because everybody I saw, they were saying, oh, the first Black president. I mean, it's historic. It's momentous. And I'm going like, is there anyone who sees the trap here? Who sees the trap here and what we are headed into? And so anyway, I had this forum. We were having forums in Harlem at the St. Ambrose Church, which is on 130th. And The first forum, we had a number of people were there, Amiri Baraka, and just about everybody was there, and they were all singing the praises for the realization of this great historic moment, the first African-American president, and surely we would see a change in the ruling class policy. We would see a change in imperialism. So some people were really drinking the Kool-Aid early. So anyway, I knew about Black Commentator, and I said, let me see here. They are like-minded folks. And I finally managed to get in touch with Glenn Ford. And he and we were having our second forum, and that was at the Shabazz Center, where we had a number of folks, including the late Amiri Baraka, and there was Glenn Ford, and I was outside pacing like, oh my God, is this guy coming? Is this guy coming? So I saw this guy bouncing down the street, looking very Parisian in a beret and stuff like that, and I'm saying, oh my God, this guy isn't coming. And I'm going to have to be the lone dissenter here in this program, and sure enough, that guy in the beret looking all Parisian was none other than Glenn Ford. And so that's how I met Glenn Ford. Later on, he was at our third forum that we had. That was with the late Bob Finch. Some of you may remember him. As a matter of fact, Counterpunch ran his presentation on Obama and the politics of Chicago and Barack Obama. Bob Fitch did that at that last program. That also included Margaret Kimberly, who started who was with the Black Commentator with Glenn Ford, and later on she and Bruce Dixon went on with Glenn to start Black Agenda Report. I just thought that was very very interesting, and we have been on a course of truth exposure, particularly the Black leadership class, the in-depth critical analysis from no other community, particularly the Black community, than that of Black Agenda Report. I'm sorry, and here is Glenn Ford coming up right now.
Nellie is always very kind to me, and I appreciate it. Power to the people. Free all political prisoners. I'd like y'all to bear with me. I need a script. I depend upon it. I also think it's important to get your words right. So that's why I have this. We're here, of course, to honor our sister, Lynn Stewart, the former political prisoner, and all of the folks who have been forced to languish in the jails of the racist capitalist state. It's also wonderful to see so many of you here in this cold weather. We have just witnessed a magnificent winter campaign launched by this new movement, which doesn't yet have a proper name, but is getting along quite well under the heading of Black Lives Matter. Back when I was young, which was a very long time ago, we always associated, or rather people associated, Black political activity with the summertime. And the corporate media tried to give people the impression that Blacks and brown people and people in the lower classes in general only got restive and agitated during the hot months. Their theory was that if the powers that be could just get past those long, hot summers, then the people with property could be safe and secure in their privileges for the rest of the year, and that law and order would return just like the cool weather. That was the theory. But of course, the long, hot summers had nothing to do with the weather. It had nothing to do with boredom in the ghetto. It had everything to do with justice and the coercive forces of the state, and that is who the police are, were never concerned about the rule of law, but only about the preservation of the ruling racial, economic, and political order. The law was whatever they said the law was. Folks on the ground, and especially black people, knew that law and order was a farce and that it was a lie, and that was evident from their daily lives. And a small group of people who became known as people's lawyers knew that too, and they used their legal training in the service of the people. Lynn Stewart was one of those shining lights, and she threw the rulers' pretensions of legality right back in their faces, as did others in that small group of people. When the rulers finally put Lynn Stewart away behind bars for the crime, and they consider this to be zealously defending her client, that was just one of many, many admissions on their part that they can no longer function under the terms of their own laws. They cannot function under the terms of their Constitution, which they wrote for their benefit, and they still can't function under it. Today, the rulers have renounced the law. Determined to rule by raw force. This, of course, requires escalation of police terror in the black and brown communities. But a state that rules by terror has given up all claim to legitimacy. And continued to be public servants. They are what the Black Panther Party said they were more than 40 years ago. They are an army of occupation, and the people have the right to resist an army of occupation. This new movement directly challenges the legitimacy of that occupation, and ultimately it challenges the legitimacy of the police, and the police are the state. They are the instrument of the state's coercive power, and they are the instrument of its claim to a monopoly on the use of power. That is the definition of the police. This movement challenges the legitimacy of that claim to have a monopoly on the use of force. That means that this movement is different, at least in this critical regard, than many other movements. This movement is not directed against a policy of the United States, such as the Jim Crow policies, policies that restrict voting rights. These are not protests that are designed to change a U.S. policy such as U.S. collaboration with the racist regime in South Africa. And it's not directed against U.S. housing policies or U.S. employment policies directly. In those kinds of movements, there are always clashes with the police or potentials for clashes with the police, but the police are not the direct object of the protests. You are not going there in order to denounce the police. These protests are aimed at changing government policies, and most often they wind up being an appeal to the government for help. But this movement is against the police themselves. It is a rising up against the coercive powers of the state. And as such, it challenges the very legitimacy of the state. It's informed by the reality of late-stage capitalism and by the ruling class's own rejection of the law as a basis of its rule, and their choice to rely on the raw power of their police and their intelligence agencies to protect the interests of the rich at home and the rich abroad. Murdering Michael Brown and murdering Eric Garner were not exercises in the law or the use of the law. They are failures to adhere to the law. It is a failure to indict the cops that was a repudiation of the law, not a lawful act, a repudiation of the law itself. In foreign policy, under both Bush and Obama, the United States has methodically dismantled centuries of international law, beginning with the fundamental right of sovereignty and of independence of nations. For the United States, such fundamental principles do not exist. It hardly even pays lip service to international law anymore, compiling lists of countries whose governments are to be overthrown and proceeding to carry out those crimes in the full light of day, in the glare of television lights. This is a repudiation of international law. The United States brags about its capability to commit these crimes, crimes under international law. When Obama says that the United States is the indispensable nation, and he loves to use that term, the indispensable nation, what he really means is that the U.S. has a right, and not just a right, but an obligation to intervene everywhere and anywhere it sees fit on its own initiative. But since the United States can no longer compete economically in the modern world, this policy of lawless use of force is Washington's only option, or at least they see it as their only option. Otherwise, they would have to become a normal nation, not an indispensable nation, and that is unacceptable. Domestically, even the procedural trappings of law are no longer operative in the United States. When one out of every 8 prisoners in the whole world is an African American, there are only 2 conclusions that are possible. Either Black Americans are the most criminal-minded people on the face of the earth, or the United States is the most racist nation on the planet with the most unjust system. The numbers tell us that those are the only 2 choices. No country could achieve the incarceration levels that are inflicted on Black Americans unless there was a total lack of due process at every level of the criminal justice system. That's the only way they could arrive at these kinds of numbers. And no country would hold elderly people in solitary confinement for 20 years and 30 years and 40 years unless their intention was to inflict terror on these people's communities, unless they were issuing a warning about what happens to Black people who challenge the United States. The plight of our political prisoners has nothing to do with adherence to the rule of law or to due process but with the absence of the rule of law and due process. And it is evidence of the cruelty of the state. Under the first black president and the first black attorney general, due process has been officially repudiated, not just in practice, but officially. Eric Holder violated not only the rules of law as taught in places like Columbia, he violated the rules of language itself when he tried to explain how the preventive detention bill, which was pushed by President Obama and signed into law by him, how that bill does not amount to a denial of due process. But when Holder was speaking that gibberish, that due process of law does not necessarily mean access to the courts, that due process of law somehow doesn't even mean a trial, he was making it official that due process does not exist in the United States. Now, back in 2010, when Obama signed that law, there was still that euphoria that Nellie was telling about, the euphoria about having a black president of the United States, a president who did not promise that he would be different, but everybody seemed to paint their own picture in their own minds about what President Obama would be. And so the vast ramifications of what nullification of due process would mean, they didn't resonate among the public at large. They were too drunk on the Kool-Aid, as Nellie was saying. But the cold-blooded murder of Michael Brown in the bright light of day on the streets of Ferguson did resonate with the black folks of Ferguson. And when the state dressed up its occupation forces in the regalia of a military conquest, the people of Ferguson said no to the occupation. And when the state brazenly and shamelessly bestowed impunity on the killer cop, the people responded with their own rejection. They rejected the state's legitimacy, the legitimacy of the state's action, a rejection of the state's claim to a monopoly on the use of force. That is, the state's agent, that cop, did not have a right to use force against Michael Brown, and the state compounded its own crime by giving him impunity. The character of this new movement emerged on that November night when the grand jury refused to indict. The whole world was watching as the most powerful man in the world went on television to rationalize the impunity that was granted to Officer Darren Wilson. And I was watching on one of the channels that had a split screen. And so on one side, we saw President Obama lecturing about some fictitious rule of law. And then on the other side of that screen, we saw the young people of Ferguson preparing to give their answer. And as the this was a wonderful moment. I couldn't have scripted it myself. As the President of the United States droned on, the young people of Ferguson exercised their right to use force in pursuit of justice. They defied the police and they lit up the place, and it was all right there on TV simultaneously with the president running down his game. Politically, they shut Obama down. That was the moment that put the mark on the movement. It affirmed a basic truth, that you can't say power to the people and at the same time allow an oppressive racist state to maintain a monopoly on the use of force. The two do not go together. The people have a right to shut it down, and that requires the application of some force. And the people, of course, have the right to resist the state and to resist the state's coercive force, the police. And that's why Bill de Blasio's police commissioner is talking about raising resisting arrest to a felony, because even contemplating resisting the police monopoly on the use of force represents a challenge to the state, and therefore the penalties must be raised. This means that this movement is having an impact on how these people think that they will be forced to rule. The new movement, which is aimed again directly at the police and therefore at the state's exercise of coercive power, has brought us to an historical juncture. It is a place in terms of organized action that we have not been in for two generations, that is, since the crushing of the Black radical movement and the imposition of a mass Black incarceration regime more than 40 years ago. That is, this is a place we have not been in since the last great wave of political imprisonment, whose survivors we are supporting here today. This evening, we'll be discussing the ways and means of fulfilling our sacred obligation to free our political prisoners. And it is urgent that we do so, not just because of the age and the medical condition of these prisoners, but because we may soon have a lot more political prisoners. Political movements that challenge the legitimacy of the state result in political prisoners. That is like night following day. Therefore, the demand for freedom for political prisoners and for prisoners of war is inseparable from all of our other demands. But I believe that our greatest obligation to political prisoners, along with those who are fighting for freedom, our greatest obligation to them, in addition, of course, for demanding that they be set free, is to create and sustain a movement. This current movement belongs to those who struck the blows and who were struck, who were captured by the enemy two generations ago. They have ownership rights on this movement. It belongs to Lynn Stewart, who defended those who were captured and who has defended the rights of all of us until she herself got put away. We must give the heroes and the heroines a strong and vibrant and militant and uncompromising movement. We must create the conditions in which they can see and sense and savor this movement as it unfolds in their lifetime. We need to write another chapter in their book. They wrote the previous chapters. We need to write the chapters that follow, and we need to bring this racist rich man's regime to an end by any means necessary. Power to the people. Free all political prisoners.
One of the people, or several of the people who this speech was directed at, are leaving. Sekou Odinga, Kazi Touré, these are gentlemen who, in the words of the Sheikh, raised their fist against power and suffered as such. But we're going to take a break now, and we're going to go to other prisoners from the West Coast, from Oregon. I've been corrected. Is it not from Oregon? Seattle? Are you ready up there, Ernesto? Ernesto. Okay, let it roll.
Hello, how are you?
Where's everybody?
Hello?
Hey, this is Mark Cook and Ed Gidding. Saying hi.
Okay, y'all see that? Darn it. Can you hear us at all? Oh, good. Yeah, Mark Cook and Larry Giddings in Seattle. See us or not, what we see is a piano. It looks like it's in a church or something.
Did they wave back?
Oh, did they? Really? Hello?
Okay,
oh, great. Beautiful. Can you see us?
Got a video on?
Oh, darn, I thought it was on already. It should have been on. Yo, is there something I can click to make it happen? Options. Okay, and that's under tools or what?
Yeah.
Okay, I got tools, options, video settings.
All right, hold it. It was told to me never to try to do the Skype because it never works. Could you give us a statement, Larry? Could you give us a statement? We cannot see you.
Okay, I got it here. No, it's on the bottom of my screen. I have a change of profile to webcam settings.
I cannot hear you. We cannot hear you. We're going to move on and see if our technicians can get it a little bit better. Now, I've been told we have representatives from the Puerto Rican political prisoners present. I see Ana Lopez standing here. And so I would like to introduce and have a few words from the Puerto Rican political prisoners at this moment. And we are running out of time. Oh, Ana has a picture there. And so come forth, Ana. Please.
I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak about one of our great heroes, and that is Oscar Lopez Rivera, who's been in prison for 34 years. He just turned 72 years old in January 6th, which is Three Kings Day. And on that day, we tried to use social media. I know it didn't work very well here, but we decided on January 6th to do hashtag Give for Oscar. We did it in English and Spanish, hashtag Regalo para Oscar. And we contacted everybody we know, and we thought we were only going to get like 100,000 hashtag. And some people said, oh, I think that's a little too much. And to our great surprise, we went over 500,000 people sent Oscar a gift for his birthday. So, you know, if we're a little scared about the social media, do use it. 34 countries participated. In 17 states, and everyone here in New York as well. So do use social media. I think it's very important to promote the campaign for the freedom of all political prisoners. We are having on May 30th here in Manhattan, and we're gonna have a march and then a rally. It's going to start in the western part of Harlem, 125th Street. where a lot of the protests against police brutality have been taking place. So we're going to march through the streets. We're taking Oscar's campaign to the streets, to the people, because that is where the power lies. It lies on our people. So we want all of you to join us. On May 30th, we're going to be assembling in 125th Street, the Adam Clinton Powell Building. We're going to march through the street and have our rally in East Harlem in 106th. So all out to free Oscar Lopez Rivera. Everyone else has been released from prison. The only one that this system, this government, continues to remind us that we are a colony, that we will continue to be their slaves, and Oscar is the person that they're using to remind us of our colonial status. I don't know if you heard, President of the Puerto Rican Independence Party, Rubén Berríos, did speak in the CELAC meeting in Costa Rica, where he addressed the member states of Latin America and the Caribbean, and made a call for the independence of Puerto Rico. And we hope that with the changes that are taking place with U.S. and Cuba, and the changes that are taking place in Europe, where countries there are changing their form of government, that it is the people power that are going to force the United States to free Puerto Rico and to free Oscar Lopez Rivera. Thank you so much.
Tell them about the painting. I am. When you're getting food the next time around, when there will be some sweets for all of you, I hope you will look at a small table behind, and on that there is a framed picture that Oscar Lopez did, and I now am the proud possessor of a raven incarcerated, and it's got the razor wire that anybody who's ever been to a jail or in a jail recognizes all too well. So that's Oscar, and that's who they've got locked up, and that's who we've got to bring home.
And a lesson from Ana Lopez, when she said Oscar Rivera Lopez is the proof that Puerto Rico is a colony. And I say, what do we say about the black communities who have all of our political prisoners in jail? It is the proof that we are nothing but a colony within the boundaries of America. And we have to do something about that. And we're going to have Mimi make an introduction, because I said we are going to have entertainment as well as speakers.
Well, I see we've also been joined by our wonderful sister, Viney Burroughs. So, but cultural workers play a critical role in uplifting our spirits. We are. We're going to do, can we do them like seriatim, as they say, one after the other? So if we can get, now some people are PhDs, but much more important than that, I know this brother as from the IND, the BMT, the IRT, from the People's Republic of Brooklyn, Professor Louis, and then we're going to hear from our fabulous Viney Burroughs.
What does it mean to be working class? Is that something from out of the past? Do we always got to come in last? That's the question I'm going to ask. What does it mean to be working class? Because today you say you're middle class. You can't pay the doctor, your car needs gas, you're still paying off your college class. What you owe your credit card is never passed. Still you're middle class this and middle class that. Upper lower middle class, till you eat your hat, got the gap on your back, you got a little fat, you're still paying for the chair where you just sat. Is it all over just like that? Who stole the good life? Where's it at? Or was middle class just a little dream made up for you on your TV screen where everybody's comfy, or so it seems, and no one ever eats rice and beans? Because in the beginning, there was just two classes. There was the elite and there was the masses. We did the work, they kicked our asses. Most everything passes. There are still two classes, those who got it and those who don't. We think we're going to get it, but really we won't. Those who own the companies and make the big deals, every deal could cost you a meal. And for real, not too many people hold the power. They make $1 million while they take a shower. There's the owning class and the working class. Where are you at? Are you slow or fast? All you got to do is do the math. If you got a job, you're working class. If you're out of a job, you're really working class. We build the houses, work the fields. We run the hospitals and fix the meals. We make the family and work at home. Sometimes that's the hardest work of all. We clean the office. We teach the kids. Everything around us is something we did. No matter what your color or your name, no matter the country from where you came, the name of the game is still the same. And if the owner works, is he working class? Got his laptop and smartphone? He's moving fast. It all depends. First and last, if he owns a bodega or a little machine shop, he works for his money and he works a lot. He might be working for everything he got, but the guy who owns the corporation, he could work all day. It won't change him. He might be a nice guy. He might be a jerk. He makes his big money off of other people's work. You can't make millions going to work and getting paid. You need other people's work to have it made. When we punch the clock, he owns the stock. We do the labor, but he gets the flavor. We make the honey, but he takes the money. Because working people make everything. We're the ones make the cash register ring. And when our work goes to someone else's profit, now you got it and you don't got to ask. That's what makes us working class. And if I talk about class just a little more, your TV says we're starting class war. But the real news has come and gone. The class war is always on. It has been here since the day you were born. We just need to know whose side we're on. If we don't know our own class, hey, take it from the poet. We will always take a beating, and we won't even know it, because your TV is programmed by the owning class. Your newspaper programmed by the owning class. Your search engine programmed by the owning class. When we don't know we're working class, the owning class will kick our ass. They get a real free pass, because you get no health care, get lousy schools. The TV brings your kids up to act like fools. You get no union, you lose your job. You vote for politicians who think you're a slob, because we sometimes forget and there's a bottom and a top, and those who got it and those who do not. Better to remember, make no mistake, you're not an owner, you're a worker, and that's the breaks. And I bet there's nobody sitting right here who made $10 million just this year. So before I waste any more breath, before I talk myself to death, let me ask you to act on a fact that has come to pass. Your ass is in the working class. And before we get to another day, when we open our mouths with something to say, before you speak and the words are gone, it's good to know whose side you're on and what it means to be working class. Is that something from out of the past? Do we always got to come in last? That's the question that we got to ask. What does it mean to be working class? And one last little question before I'm gone. Tell me, whose side are you on?
Do we need another one? Let's hear it. Do we need another one?
I'm Professor Louis, B.A.M.A., M.T.A., B.A.I. I got a degree in subway psychology. I got one in street corner sociology. I was educated like most of us out here in a school of hard knocks, you know. I went to the University of Long Work and Short Pay. I'll tell you another story. It's all right. The water won't help. The water won't help. The water won't help. is anybody's guess, but more or less, this is a story about whiteness. And my skin, you know, is white as snow. I take it with me everywhere I go, and what I got is not a passing phase. I'm white 24 hours a day, and everywhere I go, I hope I show. I already know it don't make me high, it don't make me low, but if you try, you can't deny what you see with your sight. You get a softer life if your skin is white. Your neighborhood slicker, you get a bank loan quicker. They sell better liquor. The school bus comes, the subway runs, the work gets done. The potholes fixed, the criminals licked, the IRS tricked, the garbage picked up, the library fixed up, the street light kept up, the playground swept up. We get less fake cheap drugs, less cucarachas and bugs, less 9mm slugs. You get a better house, better job, even better health. Better business, better money and wealth. And if you wonder what keeps white on top, check who gets stopped by the highway cop. Cause anyone who looks sees white people got the biggest crooks, corporate billionaires who cook the books. But if you're gonna bring just one thing that you know for sure, black people are going to jail much more. So you could like it or dislike it, but it's a fact. Not everything comes from the way you act. All over the world, they let you in by the color of your money and the color of your skin. And the lighter and whiter get an easier way. But what's the whole story, Morning Glory? What can you say? And who can you name? Who is it that really runs the game? If you looked, you saw. White people get a little more, but if you look behind the door, it's rich white people who it's really all for. When the white working guy blames the guy who's black, the rich guy laughs all the way to the bank. Because all over the world, Jim, the money's pouring in, lied and justified by the color of the skin. They're just dark people, so we don't pay them a lot. Bring them war and take what they got and gone with the breeze. When all those jobs go overseas, black and the white working guy feel the squeeze. And like I said, the white guy got a little ahead, but when he fights the war, he is just as dead. Salute the flag and do your duty, but keep one eye on the kid with the hoodie. It's a fact, Jack. It's no fun to act. Always checking behind your back. Blame everything on the brown and the black while the rich guy laughs all the way to the bank. And my skin, you know, it's white as snow. I take it with me everywhere I go, and what that is not a passing phase. I'm white 24 hours a day, and sure enough, how'd all this stuff begin? Why you don't like someone from the color of the skin? Where'd the whole thing come from? Did a white guy curse a black guy's mom? Black guy curse him back, and it was on. Well, I hate to tell you, but I gotta say, it really didn't happen that way. You start up the pump right from the jump. It was kind of crummy, just a real slick trick to pick up big money. It starts out with owners and slaves right to the grave. It has never ever gone away. The owner gave the poor white guy just a little more, told him maybe one day you'll be the big boss, made him foreman, overseer, manager, cop, just to help keep the rich guy on top. You get a little extra. You think the big guys are generous. They get you to do stuff against your own interest. And I pray today nobody plays me for a clown to help the same people who are putting me down. Because white gets a break most of the time, but white still stands on the unemployment line. And you thank the bank, the landlord, they throw you a bone, but they still throw white people out of their home. And that white soldier who fought the war, what's he eating out the garbage for? And if white is up there so high and mighty, why you need three jobs to feed your family? White, black, brown, red, or yellow has always been the same. Divide and conquer is the name of the game. And if you think people's color is your problem, you got some problems, but you'll never solve them. And when you throw the blame down on the brown and the black, the rich guy laughs all the way to the bank. And what takes and makes all his mess and division is called institutionalism. institutionalized racism. The cops, the DA, the judge, the jail, the law, the politicians without fail, the big banks and corporations, the newspaper and TV station. It's not deep down in you. It's not deep in me. It's way down deep in our society where whites got to fight, black, brown, red, and yellow, forever battling down here below, while high as the sky, up in the office tower, filthy rich white guys hold the money and the power. And now you don't got to guess. More or less, this was a story about whiteness. And you could look in a good book, don't take it from me. It is only the truth that will set us free in the mosque, the synagogue, by the church steeple. Deep down the bottom, we're all just people. And no matter what your place, someday you got to face. There is only one human race. And no matter where you run under the sun, this whole world belongs to everyone. And my skin, you know, is still white as snow. I still take it with me everywhere I go. And what I got is not a passing phase. I'm still white 24 hours a day. But it's okay to say from here to kingdom come, white don't got to make me dumb. And I hope my color don't make me too soft to let greedy rich white people rip me off. And wherever I go, I hope I show. I already know it don't make you high and it don't make you low.
But I want you to know, I have all of his records, and he has records here tonight. And so if you want to hear more, if we want to encourage intelligence and be happy about it, get records from Professor. Get his oh, I dated myself, CDs now. But we have an introduction of a great guest. Stick around, and we'll have more, Professor Louis.
Ah, I did it and didn't make any static. Wow. Okay, folks, we're going to move it along here because I dare not take the risk of Lynn Stewart approaching the stage. So, without further ado, let me introduce our next guest. When you hear the name Mumia Abu-Jamal, who do you think of? You've got it. And thank you for helping me to introduce our next speaker, the real First Lady, of the movement, Pam Africa.
I'm not that tall. On the move. Long live revolution. And long live all those who resist the tyranny of this government. Lynn is an example of resistance. Lynn, Ralph, where's Betty? That's my sis Betty. Lynn, you know, we need Lynn's help. I was getting ready to say Lynn need our help. I look at the movement, and it seems sort of splintered. I remember being out there when Lynn was going to court and seeing the news media trample over each other and start fighting to get a picture of Lynn. And all because of the example that she set. And I look, and a lot of people say, it's cold tonight, so I'm not coming out, or whatever reason. Lynn, I don't care whether it was cold, it was hot, whether she's in jail or on the outside, she have always stood for all the people. And I just want to say, it's our job to go back and bring people back into the movement. And because we're sort of crisis-oriented, when they was getting ready to take Lynn to jail, you couldn't move for people. And when Lynn was in jail, when Lynn came home, you couldn't move for people. And I'm saying it should be that way today. How many people agree with me? So I'm saying, if you agree with me, we got some work to do. And because when Lynn was inside that prison, and Lynn brought hope to many women inside that prison. And for me, Lynn brought a lot of hope and experience and to the people on the outside who know you must go outside this box. A lot of people who believe that Lynn would never come outside that prison, understand, Lynn came outside that prison because Ralph, because Betty, and a whole lot of other people took the step to kick that to kick the door open. I'm trying to be good now, okay? To kick the door open that a lot of people was afraid to kick open. And a lot of people who think they're in the know, who always want to do the same old failing thing. The prison is full of people, you know, who believe, and I'm not saying all lawyers, because Lynn is a lawyer, regardless of what they say, but who want to do things the way this government say do things when they know that it's wrong, just hoping that they can get a fair judge. There is no fair judges. There is no good cops. There is no good cops. There is no fair judges. There is no righteous politicians, because they will go all the way across the board to do what is right, and they won't compromise. Lynn, she don't compromise. But I want to talk about political prisoners, and I'll need to do more work for political prisoners. My brother Phil Africa just transitioned into prison. And Phil transitioned into a fighter, a resister, someone who went into the prison and knew damn well the chances of him coming out there the way he really wanted to come out. You could, or you don't. I want to say my brother Phil is a resistor. This government who killed Phil, no doubt in our minds. My brother Phil, when he went into the prison, he was healthy. He was strong. There was no doubt about his health. 36 years inside that prison, and first they said my brother Phil had liver cancer, which we know was a lie, but it was a possibility, and kidney failure, and they did a whole lot of things inside the prison to bring doubt to people's minds of what was going on inside that prison. But my brother Phil was dying from the day he went into that prison, because when these people control your food, control your water, and or control everything about you, a lot of people say, well, you know, I think they poison him. Don't think they poison him. Know that they poison him. But the political prisoners on the inside of the prison, we all understand that. But what about you and you and you? And what we eat, what we drink, and what we breathe. We'll go to the store and we'll buy watermelons with no seeds, cucumbers with no seeds, when the natural cycle of life, you got to have a seed to produce. And if that old saying is, you are what you eat. If you're not eating the seed of life, something is going to happen to you. People got to understand, if you're fighting for political prisoners and bypass the fact that you're not fighting for the air that they have to breathe in that prison, the water that they drink in that prison, the food that they're giving them in that prison, I was getting ready to say BSing yourself, but it is. And we talk about we want our political prisoners to be healthy and strong. How can they be when we're not fighting the fight on the inside of the prison to make sure that when they come on the outside, they're healthy and they're strong. Am I right, Lynn? Kazi, am I right? We got to understand the seriousness of what's going on here. We'll